Welcome to the Immeasurable Podcast at the Krishnamurti Center in Ojai, California. This series reflects upon Krishnamurti's work and how it directly impacts the listener. The invitation is to inquire together into the fundamental nature of our existence. Welcome to the Immeasurable Podcast at the Krishnamurti Center in Ojai, California. This series reflects upon Krishnamurti's work and how it directly impacts the listener. The invitation is to inquire together into the fundamental nature of our existence.
Hi, I'm Henry Fisher, and I'm here with Rupert Spira, author and public speaker, and Jaap Sloiter, executive director of the Krishnamurti Foundation of America. Rupert has written many books and spoken to people across all disciplines about the fundamental nature of our existence, which directly reflects the interest of this podcast. To name a few of Rupert's recent publications, The Ashes of Love, The Nature of Consciousness, Being Aware of Being Aware, which hopefully we'll go into a bit today, what that may mean.
I've always held Krishnamurti in the highest esteem, and not just esteem, but with a great deal of affection, because I grew up just down the road from Brockwood Park, so I attended all his last meetings there.
We hadn't heard.
Yes, in my late teens. And when did Krishnamurti die?
86.
Yes, so I was 26. So all through my early 20s, I would go to the to the big tent he had at Brockwood Park. Alan Rowland's playing the piano. So he was very, very, very much kind of part of my early exploration into these ideas. So I loved his fierce and tender. So I'm very, very happy to talk with you. And
I lived for 9 years in Brockwood.
So oh, did you?
Yes. So when you say down the road, is that Bramdean or?
No, it was just the other side of Alton.
Alton.
So we lived in a little village just the other side of Alton.
Rupert, I left it pretty open. I mean, there are many the angles that we could explore, and I can see when I look at and when I listen to your podcast and also your discussion with Sam Harris, I listened to part of that, and what I see what's happening in many discussions related to more spiritual topics, that there's often a big struggle to get semantics right, and I don't think we can get semantics right, but we can make an attempt to have at least make an attempt to have the same words for the same thing. But I know that the same thing might not be the same thing for each of us. So a little bit of a focus on semantics, I think, will be justified. And then the other thing which I love doing is there are like perennial questions, and what I noticed is that your background is Advaita Vedanta partially, and then non-dualism. I mean, on your website, you labeled as a non-dualist teacher. I'm not going to hold you to that label, because you know, in the end, we're all humans. We're all exploring, and we're all trying to see the light in the mist, I guess. From that perspective, I would like to explore that we're, you know, these questions are we thrown at all of us, and there's a certain tradition, or there are certain teachings, and of course the works of Krishnamurti, which we really, from my side, of course, I'm really looked at very closely, how does that sound? Does it sound as a good starting point? Are you?
Yes. I'm very happy to go wherever you'd like to go in this conversation. Please feel free to take us in any direction, and I will follow you.
Yeah. So if you look at one topic that we could explore is, and that's maybe a strange starting point for an exploration, a more spiritual exploration, but that's emotionality, in the sense of course, there's a larger question of, does God exist? Is there true perception, and what is consciousness? But more prevalent, or more directing, the more directing factor effectively, or is that we like something and we don't like something, and that we want to think we want to look for God, but actually we want to escape from pain, that there is a certain comfort in the idea of a higher being or of a deeper, you know, a truer self within myself. I mean, just to face the ugliness of oneself, in a sense, ugliness between brackets as defined by our jealousy, our struggle, our conflict, or our day-to-day life, that there's a huge drive, an unconscious drive, to escape from that. And in that escape, we create higher self, God, truth. So on one hand, there is like the possibility, or maybe the actuality, of something beyond the human suffering. But on the other, I contrast that with the actuality, is that we're scared and want to escape, and any illusion will do. So I would like to explore that with you.
I think it is a little disparaging to suggest that happiness or peace or God, if we want to frame it in religious terms, is a mind-created illusion that we imagine for the purpose of escaping our suffering. I have a very different interpretation of the nature of peace or happiness or God. Namely, that happiness is our true nature. It is what we are. It is not an emotion that we experience. It is the nature of being. And that if our being is veiled by beliefs, if the nature of our being is obscured by erroneous beliefs about ourselves, then our innate happiness is therefore also veiled. In which case, seeking happiness is not an escape from our misery. It is the gravitational pull of our being that calls us back, so to speak, to a true recognition of our essential nature, as opposed to the beliefs we have about ourselves.
That's a nice contrast to start with, right? So, and that's of course a perennial question, right? That's if you unpack, unpeel consciousness, and you unpeel the various beliefs that we have, and you peel them off, and you go further into our suffering, and you peel them off, and you solve them, or you go beyond them, then at the core of that, like I'm peeling an onion, and at the core of that onion, there's the true self. That's one way of looking, which is what you're describing, I guess. And there's the other way of framing it, which I'm not putting that out as a as a block, but more like as a nice contrast to explore. The other way of looking would be, well, where Krishnamurti would say, well, as long as there's conflict, as long as the mind is dominated by knowledge, as long as there's no freedom from the self, the other doesn't come into being. Only when there's freedom, the other will come into being. So to put it sharply, you have one model where you say, well, you unpack and the true self is there. And the other model is, there has to be freedom, and then maybe something else comes into being. How does that feel to you? What comes up when you see that?
That which truly is does not come into being. Mm-hmm. As it says both in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Parmenides, one of the founding fathers of the Western philosophical tradition, that which is never ceases to be, and that which is not never comes into existence. So we are not concerned here with anything that comes into being, because anything that comes into being will by definition go out of being. Mm-hmm. So the removal of fear does not bring something into being that is not already in being. Mm-hmm. It removes a veil over something which is eternally present, for which everybody, without exception, longs.
So how do you approach that then? How do you tangibly approach that? Like, on the one hand, we're on very familiar footing. We both read similar spiritual books, I guess. Maybe not the same, but how do you? So what then is the approach, right? Because on the one hand, I can say, okay, there is eternal beauty. There's something beyond all this, a reality beyond all this. And I grant you, of course, maybe if there's something beyond all this, it doesn't turn on and off by me being free or not free, right? I mean, that would be too petty. But still, wouldn't a mind, I think that maybe the question, to be put it a little bit more sharper, wouldn't the mind have to be free in order to be in contact with that? That's maybe the question. So is it in the mind? I put it more sharper. Is the spark already there in the onion, or the spark turns manifests when there's freedom? So
can I give you an analogy to enable us to visualize what we're speaking of? Take the example of an actor called John Smith, who plays the character of King Lear. So John Smith is perfectly at peace and happy. He clothes himself in the character of King Lear, and seems to become a king of England and a father of three daughters, and as a result, he becomes miserable. Now, the nature of King Lear is John Smith. The essence, the being of King Lear is John Smith. But John Smith has lost himself temporarily in the character. He has clothed himself in King Lear's thoughts and feelings. And as a result, he has overlooked himself or forgotten himself. And therefore, he has forgotten his innate peace. He is suffering. Mm-hmm. Now, what does King Lear have to do to recognize or to return to his innate happiness? Does he have to get rid of his suffering? And does his suffering create the character John Smith? No. In relation to King Lear, John Smith is uncreated. Mm-hmm. Lear doesn't have to do anything to his fear or his anxiety or his conflicts with his daughters. He doesn't have to attend to his suffering. He has to attend to himself. Mm-hmm. The reason he is suffering is because he's forgotten who he truly is. He has overlooked the nature of his being. Instead of understanding, I am John Smith, he believes and feels, I am King Lear. Now, nothing King Lear does to his fear, to his relationships, to his actions, to his, that, nothing he does in that respect is going to help him recover his innate peace. Mm-hmm. All he need do is let go of everything that is not essential to him. His thoughts are obviously not essential to him because they are continually appearing and disappearing. His feelings, his activities, his relationships, all of these are like so many clothes that he wears. He puts them on, he takes them off. So what is it that is essential to him? What is the essence of him? The essence of anything is the aspect of that thing that cannot be removed from it. So when King Lear has gone inside, traced his way back to his essential being, the experience that shines in him as I am, before I am is subsequently qualified by his experience. When he has taken off all his clothes, the knowledge I am John Smith shines. It is not created by the removal of fear. It's there all the time. It is... John Smith is the very being of King Lear. So the mind, of course, in this analogy is King Lear, and our nature or being or consciousness is John Smith.
And I don't mean it in a semantic way, but like, so when you say return to or remember or forget, what is the process? What happens in a mind that I assume that you use the word in a more liberal sense, like, well, you know, if I remember where my shoes are, then, you know, that is remembering where my shoes are. It's not in the same way as remembering my true self.
Remembering in the sense that it's not remembering something that we once knew in the past. Exactly, it's remembering something which we now know, mm-hmm. but is veiled from us. Mm-hmm. So in order to remember ourselves, we don't go into the past, we go into ourself. We go into the vertical dimension of being. We don't go back along the horizontal dimension of time. Mm. That's what I mean by remembering or returning to. Of course, King Lear doesn't really return to John Smith because he was never anyone other than John Smith in the first place. So when I speak of return to, I'm making a concession to John Smith, who believes that he is someone other than John Smith, in which case he has to take this return journey. Now, the mind believes that it is temporary and finite, and all its fear, its anxiety, its misery arises on behalf of its belief that it is temporary and finite. Yeah. So in order to divest itself of that belief, it has to recognize its essence or nature, its original face.
Yeah, but that still begs the question, like, when I started over, that we somehow have to take in consideration the emotionality, that's a pretty attractive picture. You know, that there's something deep down that I want to explore. And wouldn't you say that picture in itself can somehow, that idea itself can actually more obstruct a direct looking? Because it's, you know, it's like, okay, I start with, I like chocolate pie, and then, you know, chocolate pie has its consequences. So I move on, and I start to understand realize that I'm caught in conflict. I'm caught in time. I'm caught in projecting my futures and then being slave to that what I project. And then you come along, or somebody comes along and says, well, you know, beyond all this, there's something more beautiful. That becomes another part of my driving forward, right?
Because it's not, I'm not suggesting that there is something more beautiful beyond all this. If somebody says to King Lear, beyond your experience of yourself, there is something more wonderful, then King Lear would set out, he would extend himself towards that. He would continue his journey outwards to the beyond to find that. I'm suggesting that there is something more beautiful, to use your words, prior to all of this. So we don't, as this apparently separate, temporary, finite self, we don't seek to add something to ourself, this marvelous, beautiful experience. We divest ourselves through this investigation into who we really are. We divest ourselves of everything that is not essential to us. Who we really are simply shines by itself.
I will put some questions, and the question is really to make it more clear, right? What we're talking about now. The if you look at the perennial or the more long-standing quest that's here. So does truth come into being via the positively posing, the higher self, find your true nature, or does it come into being via negativa? You know, the elimination of that what is false, and then maybe something else comes into being. So
truth doesn't come into being.
No. I understand what you.
Truth is that that's which is. It is eternally present, and it is. It's not even veiled, because there is nothing other than truth in reality. But it seems to be veiled by the ignoring of it. So all that is required is the removal of the ignoring of it.
Yes.
Yeah, and this is what Krishnamurti when he said, if you get rid of your fear, if you explore your fear and get rid of that, that's what he was recommending. You take off your fear, your anxiety, your sorrow, your lack, your jealousy. You take off all of that. That's what he meant. And what remains is what's called truth or reality or love or peace or ourself.
So but my question was, of course, I agree. You know, truth doesn't come into being and all that. So I just use the word in a semantic, maybe a little bit different semantic. Right. More mean. So is the process, you know, is the process to truth? And you have these two approaches in history, also in Hindu and Vedanta history. Is it via negativa, meaning you remove the false, or is it via positiva, meaning you state the higher self and you focus on that? So how does that? Where are you with all that?
It's to remove the false or to assert the true is. It's two different ways of looking at the same, that they're not two opposing ways. Do we assert I am not King Lear, or do we assert I am John Smith? They lead to the same recognition. One is the via negativa, one is the via positiva. But what is important is that simply stating the truth, I am infinite consciousness, is an inspiration. It can give us a hint. It can awaken some sense of possibility in us, but it is not the recognition, I am infinite consciousness. So it's more than simply stating the truth. Is required, but stating the truth and getting rid of ignorance. It's the same thing.
Mm.
It's the same path, just looked at from either from the from King Lear's perspective. You take the via negativa. I'm not my thoughts. I'm not my feelings. I'm not my activities. I'm not my relationship. Mm. From John Smith's perspective, I am pure happiness. I am pure peace. Mm. I am infinite being. Mm. It's the same statement from two different perspectives. Now, as a concession, of course, there is no real character called King Lear. So you could say, well, why even speak of the via negativa? Why even say, I am not this, I am not that, I am not that? Because who are you speaking to? You're speaking to an illusory character. So that's a perfectly legitimate answer. But you could also argue, well, John Smith does not require the via positiva. John Smith does not require us to say, you are peace, you are happiness, you are God's being. So the teaching, whether it is formulated in terms of the via negativa or the via positiva, is addressed as a compassionate concession to the separate self, which, when investigated, turns out to be an illusion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but then I still, you know, then there still begs the question, I mean, and again, also, you know, that's not a new question, because you say, well, stating the truth, you know, might be, as you say, is maybe inspirational, but how do we know what is true? You know, and over the years, over the centuries, that has changed, right?
Truth doesn't change. Truth does not change. Truth could be defined as that which does not change over the centuries.
I agree. I can give you that to you, but your conception of truth or my conception of truth might be different and might be not true, right? How do I know what is true? That's what I'm saying. So you can
state
something.
How do you know what is
true? Yes.
How do we know what is true? Well, we investigate what is true about ourselves.
Yes, but you somehow have to give me a credit for the fact that our mind is an illusion-making machine.
An illusion-making machine.
Yes,
but all illusions have a reality to them. So, although the mind itself, in the ultimate analysis, the finite mind is an illusion, it has a reality to it.
Yes.
And the mind can go in one of two directions. It can either direct its attention towards the illusions that it imagines, or it can direct its attention, or more accurately, relax its attention towards the reality, which is its essence. Those are the two possibilities for the mind.
Yeah, no, I understand, but the question is more remains, and I don't know if Henry wants to speak to that, but like I would say, okay, if I say I'm gonna look at the higher truth or the eternal, because that's maybe inspiration, right? I pose that. Then how do I know that I really have the right thing in front of me? You see, or.
But I only used the expression statement of the truth or whatever it was, but because that phrase was used in your question. I don't recommend stating I am Brahman I was just using your okay, responding okay, to your okay, question. Okay. I would not recommend that. Mm. I was trying to credit that approach with some validity, that there okay. is some validity to hearing the great Mahavakyas, I am infinite yeah. consciousness, or because it might awaken open a little window in one's mind. But I'm not recommending that.
Mm.
If I recommend as a concession to the separate self that we seem to be, I would recommend investigating the nature of that self.
Okay,
because
okay.
the separate self is yeah. an illusion, but it has a reality too.
Yes, 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 yes. I think there we're on common ground. I think.
Okay, you know? Good. We met. I knew we would sooner or later.
No, but you know, I feel I'm asking these questions. It's not, and I hope it's not in order to challenge or so, or to.
No, I don't.
It's more like these. these are not our questions. You see, these questions have been asked, and I feel it's good to re-explore these perennial questions.
Of course,
just looking at and unpacking it again, we can see the pitfalls of either of the approaches, and I think that might be helpful for our for ourselves and for our the people who listen to this podcast. So,
what do you see as the pitfalls of investigating your true nature?
The pitfall would be that if I positively pose that there is a true nature, then, and that's why I started off with the emotionality, because the mind, the movement of our mind or brain, whatever you want to call that, is dominated by pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain. And this concept can just become embedded in that. The highest pleasure, you know, in the beginning, it's chocolate cake, which is my highest pleasure. And then the next thing will be my higher self is the highest pleasure, and I pursue that. So it just becomes encapsulated in that. A different name, but in itself, we're just still running after chocolate cake. That's what I'm trying to say.
Anyone who is suffering is, by definition, seeking happiness. You cannot suffer and not be seeking happiness. So let's take the case of someone who is suffering, and we recommend to them, don't seek happiness because it's just another chocolate cake. What would the, in other words, don't avoid your suffering in favor of happiness, this marvelous chocolate cake. So now, what would the experience of suffering be divested of the search for happiness? In other words, what would the experience of suffering be if there was no resistance to it? How would it be experienced?
From Krishnamurti's teachings, just to quote, he would say, it's only when you don't seek a way out, you see the suffering fully. It's the attempt to try to move away from one's suffering, to project the state outside of that. That's where the suffering is strengthened. So it's only if you want to see the full suffering happening, how the mind creates time, then you have to stay with it. Yeah.
Yes, I totally agree that to project a state away from the stuff, to imagine some future happiness. I completely agree. But what I'm asking is, if we were, instead of seeking happiness, projecting happiness in the future, if we were to turn and face the suffering, instead of resisting the suffering and seeking happiness, if we were to turn towards the suffering and accept it. Mm-hmm. What would the experience of accepting suffering feel like?
Maybe Henry can speak to this. Yeah.
Well, I'd say just this one thing that we're sort of pointing at, I think, is that there's a problem with being able to turn towards something and not want to achieve some other result.
No, but I'm responding to your previous question. Instead of projecting happiness as an escape from suffering, I'm agreeing completely with you that could be seen as an avoidance. So let's now do the experiment. Let's not escape our suffering. Let's turn towards our suffering and fully embrace it, so that there's absolutely no impulse in us to escape from it. What would that experience be? The absence of resistance to our suffering. What's the common word for that? The absence of resistance to suffering.
Well, I mean, the absence of resistance is frictionless, right? That's
it's happiness.
Flow.
Yeah. It's happiness because suffering is resistance. So if there is no resistance to our suffering.
Suffering. And Rupert, and this is actually a good point. One intermediate point, and that's because, you know, the words happiness, and that's why I'm saying there's often a semantic issue, like in how I will use it is normally not the word happiness, because I know how you define happiness, and that's great. Happiness is normally like a
causeless
pleasure.
Joy. Pleasure is nothing to do with happiness. Pleasure is to do with your sensations, a pleasant sensation. Happiness is not a pleasant sensation. We all know you can be sunbathing on the beach and be completely miserable. You can be eating a delicious meal, which is hugely pleasurable sensations. Yeah. But if you're with the person you're about to divorce, you're completely miserable. I don't equate pleasure and happiness in any way whatsoever. Causeless joy.
I understand, but you quietly capitalized capital happiness, and so now I know you use the capitalized happiness. That's good. Then I understand. We're on the same page.
Okay, good.
Yes. Go ahead.
No, you carry on, Henry.
Well, something I wanted to look at, because you brought up that analogy with John Smith and King Lear, and now as King Lear is beginning to see the inability of the pursuits of pleasure to actually reach any kind of, you know, actual happiness.
He's
starting to see that that's kind of breaking down, right? And let's say eventually King Lear is turning the attention onto himself and asking, in a sense, you know, what am I? What's going on here? First, it's what's going on here, and then it's what even am I? What is this? And my question to get very specific is in this recognition of what we are, or we could call it self-realization, or whatever it would be, is ultimately that recognition or realization, you say it's not of the past, right? It's not of the past. It's present. It's here now. But sometimes you've mentioned that as being kind of a knowing, or knowing thyself. And in general, maybe this is semantics again, but I think of knowing as something from the past. Mm. So if you can unpack a little of this realizing what one actually is, and how that doesn't just become another image. Is it being mediated by the senses at all?
Yes. Okay. When I use the word knowing, it's got nothing to do with conceptual knowledge. I use it synonymous with consciousness or awareness. So the words self-realization or enlightenment, I tend not to use them because they have acquired such an exotic flavor over the years, some marvelous experience that we might acquire in the future. So what I would call self-realization or enlightenment is simply the awareness of being, the awareness of our being, before it is qualified by experience.
And being is not experience?
Being is experienced, but it's a unique experience. It's the only experience there is that has no objective qualities.
If it is an experience to some degree, why would we not question that as well? Why is that not also grist for the mill, so to speak?
But I think we should question our being. What is the nature of our being? We definitely should question it in order to see clearly what our being is. For most people, if we were to ask most people, who are you? most people, most of us would respond, I am a man, I am a woman, I'm 32 or 47 or 56 years old, I'm a mother or a father or a bus driver or an artist or a painter, I am sick, etc., etc., etc. All these statements contain the phrase I am. And in each of these, and the I am is the same I am, mm-hmm. all the way through our lives. It's always the same I am. But the I am is qualified temporarily by a particular feeling, by a relationship, by a sensation, by an activity, by a state, by a mood. But it's always the same I am. Now, what is the nature of this that we refer to when we say simply I am before it is qualified by experience? Mm-hmm. Now, our being, if I were to ask you now, are you present? Or can you say from your experience, I am? What would you say?
Yes, I...
Of course. You are aware that you are. You are aware that you are present.
But
so
I mean...
Your presence is your experience. Now, if I were to ask you... if I were to ask you, okay, now, tell us about your being, what would you say now? Having asserted, yes, I am, or mm-hmm. I am present, how would you describe that?
I'd say my being seems to be like the fundamental operating system, in a sense. It feels like it's...
But before it starts operating, because operating means thinking. So go back even further. Before it can operate, it's true, but it's not always operating. It can exist without thinking and feeling. So prior to operating, tell us about your being.
I'll say it goes beyond thought. It goes beyond something I can conceptualize.
It's prior to thought.
Right.
It's before you start thinking, I am.
Yeah, but is that so? You know, because I
what is your experience?
No. I'm going to go into it. So is it so that the sense of self, the sense of I am, which seems to have continuity, right? We remember it as, well, it's the same I am as when I was 20, as when it's now. Now I'm a little bit older. Or is that also created by memory giving continuation to itself, creating this sense that there's a continuous I, which is sensed.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you say that the I am that you were when you were 5 years old, that the being that you were when you were 5 years old and the being that you are now are two different beings, that there is something common between both. There is something now that remembers both the being that you were, that there is something common to both experiences of yourself that gives you the continuity in time. I agree, is an illusion, because time is an illusion, but all illusions have a reality to them. So I put my question back to you. What is the reality of the illusion of continuity in your experience?
I'm trying to address that to you, because I think that's really important, right? I mean, an individual, for each person, what else do you have but that sense of self? Now, what is true here? Is it true that this is prior to thought, or is actually that sense a continuation of the self, same movement of thought, where it constantly tries in the desire, that there's the primal thing that you're actually pointing at, which you maybe feel is permanent and is out of thought, might actually be nothing more than another desire to be, and that desire to be is embedded in many thoughts, so it gives the sense of being primal. So is the truth here, right? So now I just try to put. There's a contrast, so you have the two things. So one person says, I'm delving down into myself, And I'm saying, what is prior? And I say, well, the sense of self. I always had that. Yeah. And then somebody else comes along and said, yeah, but that self, or sense of self might be constructed by yourself. And that the prime thing is the desire to be. Now, if you, for example, if you look at Krishnamurti's work, he would say, well, what is the root of all fear? And you'd say, well, that's actually the desire to be. That actually what
okay.
You talk about
the desire to be.
Yes.
So whatever it is that desires to be must not yet itself be, because it's desiring to be. So whatever it is that desires is not yet. Now, what could that be? What is it that could desire to be if that was not yet in existence?
Oh, very no, but that's because so now we're at the nature of consciousness, right? Because that's really important.
But
does it need an actor in order to have a desire to be? Or is the desire to be nothing more than the
consciousness,
the habit of the brain to recreate?
But consciousness doesn't need a desire to be, because if you say, does consciousness need a brain or whatever to desire to be, consciousness must already be. Consciousness doesn't need to desire to be. Consciousness is.
I understand from your perspective. I understand that perspective, and the perspective that you is a well-known perspective. But I'm just trying to say, well, what if we question that? What if we say, well,
No.
So what I say, Rupert, yeah, you have this sense that what you call consciousness is something outside of the stream of thought, and somebody comes along and says, well, sorry, Rupert, it's the same cake you're eating.
I don't suggest that consciousness is outside the stream of thought. That's like saying the screen is outside the movie that plays on it. Consciousness is the reality of thought. It takes the shape of thought, but it is not outside or beyond thought. It is both prior to thought and the very stuff that thought is made of. If there was no, ever-present being, no reality behind the appearance of things, there would just be things. Thoughts, images, feelings, and nothing in between them. So how would it be possible even to have a experience would just be a chaos of fragmented fragments? What would give you the how would it be possible even to have a thought? What would connect the words in a thought?
Yeah, I think that would not be too much trouble. I mean, a sufficiently complex network could do that, right? I mean, that's not that in itself would not be the challenge. The challenge is somehow now we have to be difficult, be cautious with semantics, because I would define consciousness as content, the movement of content. Now, and I know that you maybe have more consciousness with a capital C, it's a good where it's somehow, as you just said, maybe not outside of the movement of content, but somehow there's another element to the movement of content, right?
So, yeah, what do you call, it's true, we use the word consciousness in completely different ways. What do you call, so just so that we can...
Yes.
Can agree. What do you call that which knows the content of experience?
I think that would be content, correct.
No, that what do you call that which knows the content?
I understand you, and I would say that is the content. Thought itself looking at itself, right? The thought separating itself, which Krishnamurti Pun said, the observer is the observed, thought splitting itself into an experiencer and an experience, observer and the observed, the thinker and the thought. And this is, I mean, so the question is that what's actually happening? You know, we would like to have something sacred in the essence of us, but in what actually is happening is in the movement of thought, there's just separation happening. A dualism is happening. Duality.
Would you agree, Iyad, that you are aware of my voice now? Are you aware? Are you hearing me? You're aware.
Sir.
Okay. Yes. So let's call this first now number one. 20 seconds go by. I now ask you the same question. Are you aware of my voice now? Let's call it now number two. I've asked you the question twice. There was, are you aware of this sound? And are you aware of that sound? Now, the two sounds were distinct. When the first now was here, now number two was not present. And when now number two was present, now number one had vanished. So, but whatever it was that heard now number one and now number two, was it the same or was it different in you? Was it your experience was it the same you that experienced both sounds, or were they two different yous?
No, we agree. It feels like it's the same me that's listening.
Where does that feeling, you derive the feeling of it's always the same me? What is it in your experience that gives you the sense of it's always the same me? Where does that come from?
I would say memory, right? The memory thought strings various thoughts together and creates the sensation that it's the same listener who's listening.
But then something that was present listening to thought number one must still be present listening to thought number two. Otherwise, memory wouldn't have wouldn't be able to string them together.
Is that so, or? If knowledge is complicated enough and you have a network, that would not be an issue. Is a stringer required? Is something that strings it together required, or can the movement of information itself already string it together? Is it just a loop, a strange loop?
You're having to to develop such an elaborate abstract a philosophical proposition to explain your simple experience. I mean, let me ask you another question. Have you ever experienced the absence of yourself?
I have memories of those things happening, yes.
Well, if you have memory of them, you were obviously present there to remember whatever it was you were. You must have been there. If you can remember it, you must have been there. It can't have been the absence of yourself, because you remember it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because I can, of course, tell you, well, memory remembers that. You know, the brain itself is a recording machine. I mean, there doesn't need an operator to be there to record that. Nobody pressed the button to record it. Memory records. That's the nature of memory.
But have you ever had the experience, I am not present?
I have memories of that.
What were you remembering? What were you experiencing? You must have been experiencing your absence at the time,
yes.
Otherwise you couldn't remember it. So what were you experiencing?
I remember only afterwards.
You remember afterwards, but I'm not, that's it. You remember afterwards. You make a presumption about what took place actually
there.
And then,
of course.
Okay, but so now that we're getting closer now. Don't imagine afterwards what happened. Go to the actual experience. Did I actually experience the absence of myself? Not what I thought I experienced when I woke up, but did I actually have the experience of the absence of myself?
That is something I wouldn't be able to declare, right? I mean, you ask me, Do I think I had moments where there was an absence of the self?
No,
I think
there were. I know that you think you have moments. I'm asking you whether you experience moment. I'm not thinking when you wake up from your deep sleep and you say, I think I was absent. I'm talking about the experience, not your interpretation of the experience. Can you actually say then, I was absent then? Have you had that experience?
I think I did, yes.
Who had the experience? What was present to have the experience?
Yeah, but I don't think it requires somebody to be present, you see.
Well,
or somebody to have the experience.
Not somebody, I agree, but something must register the experience. I am absent.
Memory.
No, because it was a present, it was a present experience. I'm not talking about an experience in the past. What was present, not as a memory, what was present registering the absence of yourself?
Yeah, no. I think we've gotten close enough, but I don't think we will make this bridge, right?
Well, can I mention something here? Because I think what we're pointing at, this is beautiful, but it might be a fundamental difference between Krishnamurti's teachings and what you're saying, Rupert, or it may not, but I wonder what you think about it, is you seem to be pointing out what I would call fundamental nature. Okay, fundamental nature of the self. My question is, if we question the fundamental nature of the self, even that continuity, even what was present when I was a child, now, the next moment, does the questioning of it actually suspend continuity in a sense? Now, I know that what you're saying, the fundamental nature of anything, there's no way I can have an experience. There's no point in my life where this I am, let's say, is not present. But could I possibly start to assume that fundamental nature and miss the type of innocence that might come from questioning even that? So I'm asking is there an activity of questioning even that continuity or even that fundamental nature, which may be even a different dimension, one that is completely, say, unconclusive? What do you think about that? Because it's something that's
I agree with you, Henry, that one should question absolutely everything that is in doubt. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I keep going back to these questions. Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced the absence of yourself? What is it that registered the experience? Mm-hmm. What is it that is aware of your experience now? Push, 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 push. Mm-hmm. I agree. We should doubt everything.
Does that questioning end? But does the inquiry end? Or is it life itself, or does it end?
That's what we must find out. That's what each of us has to find out. You go on and on. If each of us was to remove everything in our experience that was in doubt, that we were not sure about, what would remain?
I don't understand the question. Say it again.
I was agreeing with Henry that this rigorous questioning or exploration of everything. Yeah. Doubting everything. So let's take everything that is in doubt and discard it as potentially illusory, mm-hmm. because we're not sure about it. It may just be an illusion.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's as we explore everything, let's discard everything that is in doubt. And we keep on doing this. We go on and on and on. What do we arrive at? What is left?
Nothing.
A questioning mind. Some degree, a questioning. Or well, just, it seems like a mind that in the Bible, they say something like, when Jesus has no place to rest his head. That kind of thing.
Hold on. Yeah, no, I just want to go back to what Yap said. He said nothing. Yes. Nothing is left.
Yes.
Question that, Yap.
Nothing is left. Nothing in the literal sense. That's Krishnamurti's work, right? He would say,
"How do you?"
There's no thing. That's nothing.
No thing may be left, but could there be something left which is not a thing? Could that which is not a thing be that which is present? Could it be present?
It could be. Could be. I mean, if we are questioning and doubting, we have to say, yeah, it could be, and we leave it open. The question is there, because you see the importance of not drawing a conclusion about anything, even about the fundamental nature of the self. So you're saying, I don't let my mind arrive on anything.
The mind, by definition, is limited. So anything it knows must share its limitations and therefore must be illusory. But there is one, it is an undeniable fact of experience that our experience is real. Even if everything we experience is an illusion, there is a reality to that illusion. It wouldn't be possible to know that it was an illusion if we did not know its reality. The reason we know that the landscape we see in a movie is an illusion is because we know the two-dimensional screen. We experience the screen, and therefore we can say the landscape is an illusion. If we didn't experience the screen, we wouldn't know the landscape was an illusion. We would think it was real in its own right.
Yeah, but the question, okay, what I'm trying to get at is that a questioning mind doesn't put its anchor into anything.
I totally agree. So
that's why I'm saying, if I at a certain moment have the sense, hey, you know, I really feel convinced that the self that was there 10 seconds ago is there still there, and there's something beyond, but I still question that. You see, because I don't need to form a conclusion about that. You see, there's no need, because in order to engage with reality, no conclusion is necessary.
No, I agree. It's not necessary to formulate any. Yeah. In fact, the mind cannot accurately formulate any conclusion about reality.
Yeah.
But just because we cannot formulate a conclusion ultimately or ultimately say anything that is true about reality, this doesn't deny the fact that there is reality.
Maybe.
Well, now I feel you're playing a philosophical game.
No. I mean it seriously. Because
are you telling me your current experience is not real? What would an unreal experience be?
No, I'm just saying, Rupert, and I think that's really fundamental, is that if you keep everything in suspense, if you allow doubt into everything, you have to doubt that too, your conclusion or your sense that there's permanence. That doesn't, I mean, that's
I'm
the
essence
of the question.
I'm not suggesting there is permanence. I totally agree with you. I do not think there is permanence, because permanence requires time, and time, if we question it, it turns out to be an illusion. I do not think there is permanence. I totally agree with you. Yeah. But I do, it's not that I think there is being, it is my experience that reality is.
I understand.
And that's not a conclusion. It's not an it's just that there is something that is undeniably real.
We just get into that issue of, you know, for the Christian, you know, God is. Mm-hmm. And just the concern is does doubt of everything. I mean, does it do something to, you know, our relationships, to our openness to life itself? And is there a way that if you don't mind, this is a good time to ask a question from the peanut gallery. We have two people in the peanut gallery here. And okay. one is Vincent Hernandez, who's met you a number of times, and he's a residential student with us right now. And this applies to what we're all talking about. Mm-hmm. He says, or asks, can the recognition of our being bring us the feeling of I am enlightened too soon? And not delve deeply into the mind. The sense of comfort in this recognition may not allow us to come to what Krishnamurti calls the immeasurable. What do you have to say to that?
I think if we go in ourselves to the experience to which we refer when we say simply I am, before I am is qualified by experience, we find that that is immeasurable. In fact, it is the only element of experience that is immeasurable. Everything else is measurable in some form, but to go to the experience to which we refer when we say I am, that is the immeasurable.
We need some kind of acknowledgement or something for the fact of how the mind can play tricks on us, right? And how it can hide in all kinds of things, in all kinds of statements. So in itself, just to have that kind of questioning going, and then whatever, if there's something left after all the doubt, as you said, right? If you remove everything that's doubt, there might be something left, but who cares? That's there, right? that's the thing beyond all objects of the mind. Let me put it that way.
So, yes, the thing, which is, of course, not a thing that is prior to all the objects of the mind.
Yeah.
It is that for which everybody longs.
Yeah, so maybe, hopefully, we can maybe do it again at a certain point.
Sure.
I would love to.
Well, we keep, you know, if you'd like, we keep the conversation going. It'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Keep well. And hope to see you in Ojai one of these days.
Definitely.
Yeah. Look forward to that.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you. Take care,
Rupert.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Immeasurable Podcast is a project of the Krishnamurti Center, funded by the Krishnamurti Foundation of America. For information on our online community, programs, and how to support this work, please visit kfa.org.